This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. What does it mean for a black journalist to remain neutral when talking about or writing about police brutality? Can any reporters remain objective in their coverage of climate change? In 2017, Lewis Raven Wallace wrote a blog post entitled, "Objectivity is Dead and I'm Okay with It." At the time, Lewis was the only openly transgender journalist working at public radio's Marketplace. He laid out an argument that it is impossible for journalists of marginalized identities to be neutral, reporting on debates that deny their existence. Lewis equally pushed back against publications giving space to disinformation and alternative facts as if they were political viewpoints. Lewis supported through a thorough fact-checking, of course, truth-telling, but, quote, without pretending that there is no ethical basis to the work that we do, end quote. In turn, Marketplace fired Lewis for publishing the piece. Since then, he has co-founded Press On and wrote a book on the history and theory of non-objective reporting, The View from Somewhere, Undoing the Myth of Journalistic Objectivity, is paired with a podcast with the same name, both released this fall. Lewis Raven Wallace joins me now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank.
What do you mean no object? We have to have objectivity. How can we do our jobs if we take sides?
So what I argue is that objectivity is a myth. It's an idea that anyone is able to sort of stand outside of a story. And, you know, in the intro, you mentioned this question of, you know, can black journalists be objective on race issues or can trans journalists be objective on gender issues? And I would put that question to really any reporter of any identity. So it's not just about marginalized people having a viewpoint. It's about, you know, whiteness, being a white person in a position of privilege is also a bias and a viewpoint. And so my main argument is that there is no such thing as a view from nowhere in journalism, that we all make sort of value-based and identity and experience-based judgments about what we report it, how we frame it all of the time, and that we would benefit from actually acknowledging that.
You do talk about that and the fact that in every way, 'twas ever thus, talk about this myth of objectivity and where it comes from. I think we believe that the notion of an objective journalist goes back to the beginning of time. It absolutely does not.
No, not at all. So even this concept of a neutral journalist or journalist standing outside the story didn't really emerge until the mid to late 1800s. We had a lot of press and political reporting before then, all of which was openly partisan or openly affiliated with some industry or commerce, and somehow democracy functioned as it was. And then the terminology of objectivity didn't even really emerge until the 1920s and 30s. So it's less than 100 years old as an ideal in journalism. And I think importantly, it's an ideal that was shaped at a time when it was pretty much exclusively white men in newsrooms, running journalism schools, dictating these codes of what it meant to be a reliable, good journalist.
Well, and you say ideal, but really it's a marketing tool. And in a sense, it wasn't, because at some point, the white men who controlled the media organizations decided to show more virtue, because it wasn't more virtuous. The idea was you had all of these partisan journals all over the country, and then you had the invention of the telegraph, which meant that we could now save money, the Associated Press becoming an agency, to send reporters all over to file for every one of those papers. But how are they going to do it if they had to have the Republican slant and the Democratic slant? Well, they have to send two reporters, and this is where they invented the notion of this kind of dragnet, just the facts idea. We will send you just the facts from the speech. Would you pay us to send a reporter? And they said, that's a great idea, which is how we really got going here.
Right. So the concept of a neutral newspaper or a nonpartisan newspaper was part of a new business model and distribution model that said, we're going to try to sell the most newspapers to the most people and make money off of advertising. And so there was pressure as well from advertisers to appear nonpartisan. A lot of the talk about quote-unquote objectivity even still today is more about the appearance of nonpartisanship, right, than actual sort of fairness or representation. And the pressure for that appearance is often coming from the advertisers and funders.
And the key word here, too, is partisanship. That's, in a sense, the only way we measured so-called objectivity, right, was whether or not you sounded more like you were supporting a Democrat or a Republican. But in so many ways, the press absolutely promoted various ideals that were highly subjective in its coverage, let's say, of lynching. You talk about this historically, the way in which stereotype was represented without giving it a second thought.
Right. And I think that comes to this idea that ideology is not specifically about political parties. Yeah. So in the era of lynchings, white supremacist ideology was pervasive across political parties, and doing news reporting that resisted and told sort of the truth about lynching fell upon really courageous Black reporters and editors like Ida B. Wells, her editor T. Thomas Fortune, John Mitchell Jr., who we have a podcast episode coming out about soon, who were all both anti-lynching advocates and reporters who uncovered truth and facts about lynching. That was considered sort of activist or bias and very much outside of mainstream news journalism, but it was hands down the best journalism and in some cases the only journalism about the scourge of lynching because the ideology of white supremacy was so pervasive in the mainstream
including
press.
Eastern and the Northeastern press, not talking about just the Southern press here.
Right. So in Ida B. Wells' time, the New York Times would run stories about lynching that sort of said, well, you know, but the guy who was lynched, he had done something. And often that wasn't even true. Regardless, you know, that form of terroristic violence is unacceptable. But there was kind of an apologetic tone or stance in the New York Times conception of balance around lynching.
Right. Well, take a look at the coverage of the Wilmington massacre if you want to see how the Northeastern press understood the politics of Southern dynamics and race dynamics. But what do we do then? I mean, that does leave us with a kind of a quandary. As you said, democracy functioned quite well, and perhaps because we had a robust partisan press and a lot of ideas were flowing on both sides and everybody knew where they were coming from, and we had looked about as democratic as it does today. Still, our expectations have changed. So how do we move forward? How do you function if you acknowledge that you have a very passionate idea about what's happening here?
So I am not as kind of sky is falling as a lot of people are about the state of media today, right? I think the fact that we have this proliferation of different perspectives and outlets online, podcasts has been a really great thing. And that for people who are, you know, consuming or listening to the news, sort of seeking out more and more different outlets and perspectives is a great way to navigate that. I also think there are a lot of wonderful examples, especially at the local level, of news organizations working toward more transparency about their values and their process and more kind of direct accountability and relationship with their audiences and their listeners and sort of rebuilding what are often broken relationships of trust between people and media. And I think objectivity at this point has become more of a barrier to that rebuilding of trust than something that's helping with it because there's so much confusion about what does that term even mean and who's being represented. And so getting back down to brass tacks of, you know, trust is about relationship, and journalists and news organizations can be in relationship with the people and communities that we're covering.
Well, let's do that because it ultimately this the problem branches. The question of whether there can be objectivity is one that we can examine, and the more you examine it, the less it looks like objectivity is anything we should ever embrace in the first place. On the other hand, then there's the question of what do we do in the marketplace of ideas. Let's leave that second one alone for a moment and get back to objectivity. And this whole question of how, even in science, we probably do ourselves a disservice to think that we can objectively stand apart from nature. It seems to be the first mistake. And then observe everything and then come together and pontificate on exactly how it worked because we had some perch from above it all and we told you how it worked.
Yeah, and I think in my process of writing this book and now working on this podcast, I did have to move beyond kind of the superficial critique of objectivity as, you know, problematic because it pretends that anybody can be apolitical, and into like a deeper look at objectivity as problematic because it's this idea that any of us can sort of step back and be outside of the world, and how that becomes this kind of objectification of the people and the stories that we cover. You know, they become objects separate from us. And, you know, I wrote about this at the end of the book in terms of climate change and the rising temperatures and the rising water, that, you know, if we see ourselves as separate from the world, I think we do a disservice to sort of the truth of covering climate change, and that we truly are all implicated and all sort of viscerally and physically participating in and feeling and experiencing that. And so a journalism that can reflect, again, that sort of relationality instead of the objectification of the world and the people that we cover, I think is what I am striving toward.
Yeah, I think putting it in that context is important, and it really does shine a different light on this. When you think of objectivity as objectification, then not only is it not a virtue, but it really is a very serious impediment to improving the situation of everybody around us, because it begins with a lie that we can stand apart. The second lie is that we're not in relationship with each other, and that somehow telling the story as though we're not in relationship would make things better. But then now we are back at the second part of that question, which is, what do we do? How do we tell stories anymore? If in a world particularly where it's so easy to separate ourselves from those with whom we disagree.
Well, you mentioned the marketplace of ideas, and I think there's something sort of at the center of that that I want us to move away from, which is kind of the commodification, right, of facts and truths and stories themselves. So I think there are a lot of answers to your question. There are so many people telling stories about their lives and their experiences in their communities who maybe aren't seen as journalists or aren't working as journalists. And that's fine. And that's one of the things that we need. We also need journalism that's more transparent about its values and accountable to the communities that we cover. And we also need, I think, defiant and oppositional journalism, journalism that does take a stance and that stands up to disinformation and misinformation and calls a lie a lie, because it is a power struggle out there. You know?
Well, and the terminology is important. We use reporter and journalist interchangeably, but really they're not at their root. A journalist is a journalist. A journalist is an individual who goes around and reflects on the things that they saw, you know, in various circumstances. It is at root expected to be a very subjective observation about kind of what that individual saw. A reporter, perhaps by definition, is expected to be more dragnet-like and just report the facts. So there is a space, even in traditional journalism, mainstream journalism, for a subjective point of view, weigh them all and aggregate them. But let's talk about how this works in the real world and how political movements, which again is relational, people coming together, have affected the way we tell our stories. Black Lives Matter, for instance, has really changed the way storytelling is done about a very important institution, law enforcement, right?
So I told a story in the book about working in a public radio newsroom in Ohio at the time that the Black Lives Matter movement really blew up. And we actually covered a police shooting of a young black man inside of a Walmart that happened just a few days before Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. And this was a real sort of awakening moment for me as a white reporter and editor. I had covered this police shooting story a few days before Michael Brown without looking into the race of the person who was killed, the race of the police officers, or the implications of that incident. After Michael Brown was killed and Black Lives Matter became a much more visible national movement, there was activism locally where I was in Ohio, and suddenly John Crawford III's death became the biggest story that we were covering and a big focus for us. And so I learned a lot about how activism from outside of our newsroom, from Black Lives Matter activists, could influence how I, as a white reporter, saw a story, how important I thought that story was, how much we reported on it, you know, all of that. And so it was a real moment of kind of looking at my own biases, but also seeing this really dynamic interaction between Black Lives Matter as both an activist movement and a media movement that said, okay, the mainstream press isn't covering these police killings. We're going to tweet out these stories. We're going to Instagram about it. We're going to be there on the ground telling these stories and taking the place of what they very rightly saw as missing and inaccurate stories in mainstream media. And I had essentially stood on both sides of that at different points.
And we might call that in another age, we would call that consciousness raising, perhaps being woke. In any case, it talks about the problem of objectivity. Objectivity based on what consciousness? And what did you know? And what were your assumptions going in? So you can only be objective based on the limited stuff that's in your head and how you received it and all of the distortions that were built in. So I think that story illustrates it. And in one chapter of your book, you look at the relationship between mainstream media and LGBT weeklies during the AIDS crisis back in the 80s.
Yeah, and I was really inspired by those stories because it was the gay newspapers like the New York Native in New York City and the Gay Community News mm-hmm. in Boston that did the first and the best coverage of the AIDS crisis because they had to, because it was such a big story in their communities. And the New York Native for years was reporting cover stories all of the time about AIDS, while the New York Times, so many more resources and right in their own backyard, was ignoring that story for years, you know, scarcely reporting on it at all. And so the gay community reporters were also activists who were pushing, they were demanding meetings with the New York Times, you know, leadership. They were going in and saying, you need to be covering these stories. They were very much both and reporters and activists. And that legacy was, and I think continues to be, so important to telling the real stories about the AIDS crisis.
And that, I think, is because so-called activism makes you aware of certain information that, again, would be glossed over or ignored by people whose life and experience hasn't been that. It's not that it didn't happen. It's that you didn't notice because it's never happened to you or anybody you know.
Right. And depending on where you stand, your own life experience may or may not be sort of politicized, right? So being gay in the 80s, like a very politicized experience, you could be fired from the New York Times or the Associated mm-hmm. Press for coming out as gay. So it was inherently kind of an activist stance to be an out gay reporter, you know, which is very relatable for me as a trans reporter working over the last 10, 15 years in media, going from a time when there was almost no representation of trans people to seeing more and more of it. But, you know, this idea of are you or are you not an activist is just very different when you've had to advocate for yourself in order to even be a journalist or be moving through these different kinds of spaces.
You also warn against these false equivalencies as though there's anything but, you know, human-caused climate change because of the preponderance of evidence, you know, sort of asking the other side to give them equal time is a bit of a dodge.
Yeah, and I think we see so much of that. I mean, the concept of balance is very easily exploited by people who want to distort the truth, and has been exploited by certain right-wing media activists to sort of say, oh, we need to balance, an anti-racist perspective with a racist perspective, for example. And we still hear that kind of thing going on, on our airwaves. And climate change is obviously kind of the banner example of false balance being used and sort of deployed in a really, really damaging way to keep us talking about whether or not climate change was real at the exact time when we needed to be talking about stopping it.
This is not exactly a new conversation, been going on for quite a while in one form or another, but I wonder what kind of response you're getting these days from journalists.
A lot of
reporters.
Yeah, sure. A lot of really nuanced and interested and excited response. I think there are a lot of, especially younger reporters and reporters. I'm like an old millennial, so reporters on in my generation and younger mm-hmm. Who really feel like, yeah, this is exactly the conversation we need to be having, because the framework for objective journalism that's still being taught in journalism schools and talked about in newsrooms isn't reflective of the sort of environment of politicization around identity and the environment of multiple voices and the internet age and all of that we've grown up with really isn't reflected in the objectivity framework. And so we do need new ways to talk about ethics in journalism. So particularly from younger folks, I think there's been just a lot of excitement. Many, many journalists from marginalized backgrounds are really frustrated with their newsrooms and feel like it's risky to speak out. And so I hear from those kind of folks a lot, too.
Lewis Raven Wallace, a Durham-based freelance journalist, co-founder of Press On. He is the author of the podcast and host of the podcast. He is an author, host of the podcast The View from Somewhere. And you can check out his work and links to his stuff at our website, stateofthings.org.